Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour,
how does the design of a city and its architecture affect democracy, community, our psychology, and public health?
And first, an analysis of the historical roots of the present-day political turmoils, divisions, and partisanship in the United States, the fault lines that fractured the U.S. Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. He's the author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism, On Capitol Hill, The Struggle to Reform Congress and Its Consequences, 1948 to 2000, and his latest, Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. Welcome back to the Scholar's Circle. It's great to have you back, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the title, Fault Lines, as in earthquakes, as in faults under a looming earthquake, which I suppose in this particular book is about this divided, polarized America. Is that how you meant this?
Yeah, that's how we meant it. We're trying to trace over four decades of these very deep divisions that have separated different parts of American society, and which created the path to where we are today. There are the political fault lines between the two parties as they've moved further apart, the economic fault lines as you've had a increased division between the rich and the poor in this country and an increasingly fragile middle class, the racial fault lines that have continued to haunt this country even after the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And finally, the fault lines we talk about around sexuality and gender, which have been issues front and center also since the 1970s. And so we do want to emphasize how deep the divisions are and how they've influenced the character of our public square.
Do you have a sense that these divisions would not be so deep and so pronounced had we not had some provocateurs, so to speak?
There's something to that. We don't argue that all of these divisions kind of bubble up from the bottom up. So they're not all a product of how Americans feel very clearly on every issue. They're often provoked either by provocateurs or by the way our institutions have worked during this period. So in terms of the institutions, we look at how party politics was remade after Richard Nixon to really promote and incentivize partisanship. And then within this world, we look at figures such in the media, for example, like Rush Limbaugh, who was a conservative talk radio host who in the late 1990s worked in the new media environment that had taken form and really tried to play to the base, as we say today, and to stimulate those feelings of division for their own purposes. So there are very real divisions and tensions over many of the big issues of this period. But the key is that we don't have institutions anymore that push against it. We have institutions that actually try to promote this, and the people within those make their living and gain their power by fostering division.
Let's talk about those institutions. Obviously, the media institutions are one of them. And so you've got this polarization that you started the book with and then continued on discussing. Do you see this as the chicken or the egg?
We think the media is actually, it's a chicken. And we try to trace the history from when you had a few network channels, CBS, ABC, and NBC here in the States, really were the only sources of news and the handful of major city papers, to a period that starts with the advent of cable television in the 1980s and the 24-hour news cycle, moving forward into the partisan era of news that you see take form in the 1990s with Fox News and talk radio, into the era of social media where there are no filters anymore on information. It's very easy to get information out, and it's very hard to control what's in our public square. And that history is really important, not just because it reflects a divided country or it reflects the polarization. It actually fuels it. More people get their information about politics from news sources that will only give it to them from one point of view. Politicians employ the media, they use the media to advance their agenda. And as we see with President Trump and Fox News, for example, it's a pretty powerful alliance, and it really does help to foment some of the tensions that we see today.
So, yeah, it's interesting about the provocateurs who clearly benefit from this kind of chaos. And in this new environment that you describe, it seems people get rewarded for hostility and punished for, you know, sane, rational discourse.
That's exactly right. So in the world of the media, 2018, 2019, meaning this world we created, there's very little benefit to giving a level-headed, nonpartisan analysis of what's going on in Washington. But instead, if you say something provocative, what's called, you know, clickbait statements, clickbait headlines, you're much more likely to gain an audience. The way the news media works today, audiences matter, whether you're talking about the ratings for television networks or you're talking about the hits or the likes that a social media site or a tweet receives. That's why the incentives work that way. And it's the same in politics. People talk about the problem of how gerrymandered our districts are. The reason that's a problem is members of the House of Representatives look back to their electorate and they understand that if they try to play to a center, they will lose office. So the way to keep your power is to play to the base, to play to the most active in your constituencies. So the incentives help understand why the world works the way it does here in the States.
So if you were going to pinpoint timing, you looked around 1974 for this particular book. Why that particular era and those years?
There were some institutions in the post-World War II period, the 1940s and 50s, that pushed against the divisions that existed in that era. And so, for example, the very strong role of the federal government provided a common threat through much of the country during that period. The era of network news certainly didn't allay all the divisions in society, but it provided a common point of information. And even unions were very important in the economy, and they connected different social groups and different sectors of society through this workplace institution. And what you see in the 70s is a lot of these fall apart as a result of the crises that the nation goes through. And we start the book in 74 because that's when President Richard Nixon steps down for an office. He resigns in one of the worst scandals in American history. That moment itself is traumatic and I think important moment to begin our exploration of the current period, but it also brings together many of the tensions that had been bubbling up over Vietnam, over domestic relations, over the presidency. And we believe that's really when the transition happens. And you could even see it in the economy, for example, as we move into our current high-tech service sector-based economy.
You know, I wonder a little bit if maybe that moment when Richard Nixon steps down in what was then the, you know, the big scandal, which today would probably not be such a huge scandal given what we're facing. Like maybe that's worth a contrast at some point. But maybe what's happened is that it just brought it to the surface.
I think that's exactly right. And that was the discovery of Nixon's resignation. There were many people in the country that hoped it would heal the nation and it would resolve our problems of having a president with too much power. That was the idea. Well, the process worked, the system worked. But really, Nixon was a product of several decades when the presidency had been gaining a lot of power and we had seen an executive branch that looked very different than what we had in the 19th century. And with Nixon, it had just gotten in the wrong hands, so to speak. And so when he steps down the presidency, there are reforms, there are efforts to constrain the presidency on making war power, even on the budget. But in the end, they're of limited effect. And the presidency will regain its strength and even get stronger, we argue, by the 1980s and 1990s. And so that's why what you're saying is very important to understand. And it also helps explain part of why Nixon's resignation on its own didn't cure the problem.
You know, you talked about in the book a particular Supreme Court decision, and I want to bring this out because there's a lot of focus on Citizens United as a really detrimental decision that the Supreme Court made, which I would agree with. But really, its predecessor, which you talk about, Buckley v. Valeo, was perhaps the turning point in terms of issues around corruption and electoral integrity and gaining power for the extreme wealthy. And how would you see that?
It's a really important decision. One of the positive beneficial effects of 1974 and the crisis of Watergate had been that it stimulated Congress to pass campaign finance reform legislation. And the legislation included a number of provisions, including a public finance system for presidential election. It included limits on contribution. And quite dramatically now in retrospect, it also included limits on how much could be spent in election. And all of this was an effort to undercut the power of money in American politics, because Congress realized that was part of what was going on with Richard Nixon. Some of the scandal involved the impact of money on public policymaking, but the Supreme Court knocks a key part of that down in this Buckley v. Valeo decision, and they decide that congressional limits on campaign spending was an unconstitutional violation of free speech. And the idea was spending money in elections was the same as free speech and the ability to say what you want. And from that point on, a key reform, a key accomplishment of the post-Watergate era is undercut, because while you still have limits on how much people could raise, you don't have the same kind of limits on how much people could spend. And the pressure will keep mounting. And it also allows wealthy individuals to spend huge amounts on their own campaign, which will become relevant in recent years with some independent candidacy.
And turned money into speech, which I think is highly significant as well.
Yeah, and right after, I mean, in the years that follow Buckley, between 76 and the early 80s, you see this expansion in Washington of corporations, not just umbrella associations in a particular industry, but even companies set up shop in Washington on what's called K Street, and they form lobbying groups, and those lobbying groups really depend on these new campaign finance rules to exert influence. And the flood of money starts then. It's only gotten worse. And Citizen United made it worse. The president's abandoning the public finance system made it worse. But the origins of this are in that 1976 moment when the reforms were undercut just 2 years after being put into law.
So that was a new phenomenon. And now, of course, we face the sort of unbridled, I don't know what to call it. It's not just, it's like a legalized corruption, I suppose, because it's removed the democratic element.
Yeah, that's the fear of what's going on today. It hasn't totally removed it, and that, you know, voters can still vote.
That's right.
And they
that's
obviously, right. They can change the country, as we've just seen. That said, money is very significant. And what it does, not just in elections, but in policymaking, it creates a system of unequal access. If you have money and you have the capacity to donate, the access you get to make your case to a legislator or to the president is much greater than your average citizen has. And that's where inequality is very real in the political system and undercuts some of the election. And it obviously has effects in elections themselves. In that while voters still matter and grassroots movements matter, people with money, organizations with money, can really sway elections. And so this is a problem in our current life that shouldn't be discounted.
So then you talk a bit about Jimmy Carter, and you showed him as sort of this antidote to Watergate and all it represented. But your assessment of his presidency is quite mixed. In hindsight, how do you assess Jimmy Carter?
Yes, one way to look at him is someone who is more successful on policy than we remember, but really not very good on politics. So in terms of policy, there are a number of accomplishments that were significant even over time. He's really the first president to put the problem of energy and conservation on the agenda in a very serious manner. He introduces human rights as a permanent concern in U.S. foreign policy. And the Camp David peace accord between Egypt and Israel is quite remarkable, given it's one of the few achievements of peace in that region. It lasted for decades. But politically, Carter never was able to rebuild the democratic coalition that had withered in the 1960s. He's not particularly concerned with that part of the presidency, and he doesn't leave his party any more united by 1980 than it was when he took over in 1976. And that has a cost. It helps create a path for Ronald Reagan to come into office and for a conservative movement that had taken form in the 70s to enter into the halls of power. And so that's a kind of mixed assessment of what he did.
Yeah, it's sort of like he was a visionary in terms of the future, but in terms of leadership for politics, for the nuts and bolts of elections and campaigns, not so much.
Right, and there's a cost to that, meaning you can't disconnect politics from policy, in that his achievements come under threat during the 1980s. And many of the ideas he wasn't able to fulfill don't find much support in the new conservative era of politics, because the person in power, Reagan, and the Republicans in Congress have little appetite for a lot of what he wanted. So I think Carter saw the cost of not doing more on politics, not doing more to focus on the health of his party as much as the ideas that mattered to him much more.
You also noted the role of oil in the economy and the politics of the world. What was oil's role in the fault lines and the loss of confidence in the economy?
Well, it was very important in that during the 1970s, the U.S. goes through an energy crisis, which includes two major crises points when OPEC limits the supply and thus increases the prices of oil. And in 1973 through 74 and in 1979, Americans are facing massive gas lines and a shortage of supplies. And it fuels a sense in the 70s that our economy was no longer what it had been a decade or two earlier, that we were no longer in what was called the American century, where our economic institutions, our companies, were the strongest in the world. And the oil crisis is part of a general economic crisis that's very real. Not only are we unable to control our energy usage and energy prices, but the entire manufacturing sector of the economy, which depended on that oil, is starting to really weaken and lose in competition to countries such as Japan and West Germany. And Americans suffer as a result of all this what's called stagflation, the combination of inflation and high unemployment, which economists always said couldn't happen hand in hand. And so when Carter finishes his presidency in 1980, part of the reason so many voters are frustrated and want something new is they are struggling. They're facing high prices. They don't have enough gas for their cars, and they don't have jobs. And it felt, if you were living in 79 and 1980, for many Americans, like the bottom had just totally fallen out of an economy which used to almost guarantee that your kids would do better than you would.
So let's turn to race and ethnicity. You said that most Americans, you know, welcomed the dismantling of segregation. Why did it contribute to the chaos?
Well, the shift that happened that we really hone in on in the 70s is the nation has done a lot. Congress has passed the Civil Rights Act, which is about legal segregation, passes in 1965 the Voting Rights Act, which is about voting discrimination. But the problem that was on the table in the late 60s is what's called institutional racism, the way in which racial injustice and division is inscribed into our institutions. And so even if people are not openly being racist, they participate in a system that keeps perpetuating racial injustice, the way that real estate worked, for example, and housing is one example that people point to. The way our education system was set up created unequal access to good education, or the way criminal justice worked constantly created pressures and dangers for African Americans that didn't exist for the rest of the country, as we've seen on policing. And this is a problem that we don't ever form some consensus around. There's no big legislative breakthroughs on how to deal with institutional racism. And this is a problem that affects the North as much as the South. So as civil rights activists started to push the agenda into this area, the tensions became much more severe around the country. It was no longer a regional fault line. This was something that was very much inscribed in our politics. And some politicians play to it for their own advantage. We talk about Lee Atwater, who ran George H.W. Bush's 1988 presidential campaign against Michael Dukakis, and the way in which he used race in certain advertisements to play on these feelings that still were very much alive and well in 1980s America.
So again, we come back to this idea of provocateurs, and provocateurs for their own self-enrichment, so to speak, even if it's political enrichment, not monetary.
That's right. And both are equally important. And obviously, in the world of politics, power is as much the commodity that's traded as money. And there are just a lot of incentives in this partisan polarization we've been talking about, certainly for parts of the Republican Party to mesh those with racial division. And that goes right through the Trump administration. But there were actual incentives for them to do that. And they were used more frequently than we remember.
So let's turn to the cultural issues around gender, sexuality, the family. You noted that feminism really arose from chronic discrimination, particularly in the workplace.
Yeah, well, this is really important. We trace the feminist movement of the 70s and the transformation that it achieves and the limits of what it achieves. And we really tried to bring in a lot of the scholarship on the workplace. And the way one of the interesting stories is the feminist movement, the awakening of feminism and it's becoming a national political movement, converges in the 70s with this economic crisis we were talking about. And you have more women entering into the workforce as much for pragmatic needs as anything else. The idea of a single wage earning family is becoming less tenable by the 1970s. And so this, you know, changes notions of gender, changes place, ideas of work. In part, it's just a response to the new realities of 1970s America. And it has a big impact. You have, you know, feminist organizations are taking form and they're increasing in terms of their strength during this decade. You see a proliferation of publications like Ms. Magazine, which are starting to focus on questions like sexual harassment at the workplace. And you have some, although it's much slower, increasing presence of female politicians at the national and state level. But the economic part of that story we're really interested in, and it connected these two aspects of our story.
And then, of course, the move for equality for gay, lesbian, transgender people as well.
Yeah, that's a story that usually receives less attention until recently. If you look in the trail, you know, at the end of textbooks, which usually end in the 1970s, it's on the radar. They usually will talk about the Stonewall Rebellion, which was a riot in New York City at a bar in response to police harassment. But the gay rights movement is really quite a powerful force by the 1980s. It starts by talking about issues such as same-sex marriage. You already have protests on that particular question and the rights of gay Americans on issues like police harassment. But in the 80s, it's really a moment we write a lot about this as a counterpoint to the Reagan Revolution. And where you really see its power is with the AIDS crisis. Initially, when this disease starts to ravage the U.S., what's striking is the Reagan administration totally ignores it. Ronald Reagan won't talk about you won't even use the word. There's one story we tell where Larry Speaks, the spokesperson for the president is talking to reporters and he makes jokes about AIDS. Kind of, there's no one in the White House who would have this. And what's remarkable is the movement organizes ACT UP forms, which is a group that demands government attention to this issue. By the end of the Reagan administration, the attention is starting to be paid to the issue. And fast forward to George W. Bush, who's a Republican conservative president, in 2005, he launches a massive initiative to fight AIDS in Africa. And all of this isn't just the natural evolution of the country. It's a result of this gay rights movement that puts these issues of sexuality and family directly on the table.
Now, of course, we have Dick Cheney in that White House who is torn between the culture wars because of his daughter.
Yeah, that he's a really interesting figure. Cheney is a Republican who's first part of the Ford administration. He's then in Congress in the 1980s and Secretary of Defense under George H.W. Bush. And he's a staunch conservative. But this is an issue where, in part because of his family, he's not on the same page as the religious right, which is such an important part of the conservative movement. And it comes up when he is running as vice president and debating, and this issue is brought up by John Edwards in 2004, it backfires when it's used against him. But why it's interesting, it reflects, this is one question where that red-blue divide starts to soften, and some of the cultural changes go well beyond blue states versus red states. You can see this today in how a lot of the Republican Party has shed some of that antagonism toward gay rights issues, which back in the 1980s were almost an orthodoxy for a lot of the party.
Yes. So now if we could come full circle to today, how do you connect all of these dots to where we are today? The culture wars and the crises we saw with the integrity of the government, the lack of confidence in the government, the deep polarization. Now what?
Well, we made a world coming out of the 1960s, which we're still living in. And the first thing you need to do is to understand that our current turmoil, whether you're talking about President Trump or whether you're talking about these intense battles over social issues such as reproductive rights, are not new. They're not even 5 or 10 years old. They're over 4 decades old, which means they're really cooked. They're baked into our culture, into our institutions, and they're going to be around for a while. But if you take someone like President Trump and you look at, for example, why does he govern this way? Why does he use the rhetoric that he does? Why is he so focused on conservative cable television? Why is he playing to issues like immigration restriction and now late-term abortions? It's part because this is how the Republican Party has been evolving for a long time, and it was kind of predictable that it was going to end up here. It certainly doesn't solve your problems, but it gives you a better sense of how deeply rooted what we're watching today and what troubles so many people is. The only solution it points to is you have to look back to the roots. If you're serious and say, this is not tolerable and we need to change the way our politics works, it's going to take the kind of thing you saw in the 70s, where the political reform is a big issue that people take seriously. How does money work in politics? How do we handle the districting process? Media organizations have to look deep at how do we produce the news and what kind of alternatives do we offer viewers, readers, and listeners. Until those kinds of questions are asked, you know, we might have a tamer version of what we see in 2019, but it won't fundamentally change. And for us, that's what the history really points to.
And I think that the incentives today are just really strong to keep them, if that makes sense. So even if we were to look back and to say, okay, well, you know, this is just really abhorrent to me. It's costing us democratic governance, whatever, you know, integrity, the corruption, the inequality. But when you look at it, you go, but the incentives are so strong for so many people to hold up this system.
That's absolutely true. There's two sources of potential change that we see in the period we study. One is just a major crisis or scandal. I mean, the book starts with Watergate, and it shows what a scandal of that magnitude can do to the body politic, how it could shake things up and move us in a different direction. So that is obviously on the table as we speak, given what's going on with the White House under President Trump. The second part of the story, which I think is relevant today, is consistently throughout this period, even with the divisions and dysfunction, social movements have been able to reshape our ideas and push politics in new directions. So whether it was the conservative movement in the 70s giving rise to ideas such as, defending the family through certain principles, or the gay rights movement and the impact it had on AIDS research and marriage, to the Parkland students who mobilized and have been putting a lot of pressure on the table on gun control, social movements like a scandal have the ability to move us. So it's going to be very difficult, and the odds are it won't happen quickly, but the system is never static. And the best part of the story is when it changes, it's often average citizens who get together and care about a problem who are able to have the biggest impact on our bigger history.
Two questions for you on that. One is, do you think that from Watergate to today, and there have been a lot of other little crises that went along between then and now we're dealing with the current one, but do you think Americans are really quite inured?
I don't know. I think we have a fragile system and we often take it for granted. And I think what we're seeing globally now suggests just how fragile our democratic institutions are. And I think if you're just an American watching presidential politics, you see all these assumptions you have about how things will work or how systems will be checked doesn't actually turn out that way all the time. And I don't know kind of where a lot of the country is on this. I don't know if they are sensitive to it. I don't know if they're numb to it, that at a certain level, this is what it is, this is what it's going to be, and they will just let it happen. But I think one of the effects of President Trump has been to call attention to some of these flaws or these problems and challenges that we are facing. And you're seeing that with Brexit overseas and in many other countries. And the best kind of outcome is that actually pushes some kind of discussion and deliberation about doing something about the risks we face.
And then the other question, I said there were two, deals with what you said about social movements. And I think about what you said in terms of, well, it's not going to happen quickly. It'll happen over time because that's how social movements work. You know, we've got sort of these idea entrepreneurs and they carry these ideas and broadcast them and platform and people sign on to them. But I don't think we have ever had a time when we were under such an existential threat to the point, because of climate change, to the point where I'm not sure we've got the time. How do social movements function when they need time, when we don't really have time, given how much that will exacerbate all of the other problems?
That's a million-dollar question, and that's a challenge that's ominous, meaning it is a particular kind of crisis, unlike even a national security crisis or unlike certain economic crises, where the last minute response, which we often depend on or have relied on, won't work, that you reach a tipping point, and we hope we're not there yet, where you can't reverse the damage. You can only do very little to curb the effects. And climate change is one of those challenges or crises that will affect everything else, from public health to our economic well-being. It seems there's still time. And it does seem that at least in party politics in the U.S., one party is pretty much on board with trying to take government actions right now to try to curb the impact, as are some parts of the corporate sector and some states. So it's not hopeless. There is a will there. It's not as if it's devoid, our political system, of any strong support. But it will take environmental activists who have been really changing public ideas successfully since the 70s to crack through this gridlock moment we're in. And I do think it's going to be a partisan issue. I think it will come, if it comes, when Republicans, you know, feel the consequences of the direction they've taken on some of these issues. A little bit like 1964 after Barry Goldwater lost in a massive landslide to Lyndon Johnson, and it opened the door for Democrats to push things like civil rights and Medicare that had been locked up for so long. You need a combination of grassroots and dramatic elections. That's the only way this is going to happen, but you're right. It has to happen soon. We can't wait 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, we no longer have that time that we had in the era of previous social movements. Final words, final thoughts?
Well, final thoughts are, we wrote a book about the history that history classes never look at. The story of our lives, my co-author and I both lived through this period. So we worked hard to try to make sense of what we lived through and what many of our readers lived through. But we do believe that studying this history, understanding it more as history just than what you remember, hopefully will help at least stimulate the conversations we've had today, and even better, actually create some momentum to solutions for some of these big challenges we're facing. And we hope the history is at least part of that mix.
The book again is called Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. And we've been speaking with Professor Julian Zelizer, who is a co-author of the book, along with Kevin Cruz. Thank you so much again for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thanks so much for having me.
Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. He is the author of Arsenal of Democracy, The Politics of National Security from World War II to the War on Terrorism, On Capitol Hill, The Struggle to Reform Congress and Its Consequences, 1948 to 2000, and his latest, Fault Lines, A History of the United States Since 1974. When we come back, how does the design of a city and its architecture affect democracy, community, our psychology, and public health? Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Why are some cities bursting with life, beauty, and community, while others feel dangerous and isolating? Our next guest argues that it's largely in a city's design. Well-designed cities, he says, encourage vibrancy, safety, happiness for their dwellers. What are the secrets to make what he calls cities for people? Dr. Jan Gehl is a professor emeritus of urban design at the School of Architecture in Copenhagen, Denmark, and author of the book Cities for People, and he's an award-winning architect. So welcome, Jan Gehl.
Thank you very much.
The most profound aspect of what you've done in this book is this idea that architecture has these really profound psychological effects on people. One example was you talked about large spaces and tall buildings signaling a particular kind of environment, whereas small spaces like Venice, for example, signal another. Can you explain this effect and give us some more examples?
I'm speaking quite a bit about what I call human scale. And for me, human scale is based very much on how we can move, how our senses work, how we can pick up things, very small things at short distances, how we don't need much space to maneuver while we are walking, whatever. And in all the old cities, right up to about 1960s, you could see that more or less the human scale was observed. There were spaces of nice proportions. But then after 1960, when the city started to grow, and when we started to mechanize building and were able to mass produce big buildings, And also when the automobiles came in and we started enormous landscapes which were made to make the cars happy rather than to make the people happy. And in the book I do much talking about the 5 kilometer or 3 miles an hour which you can find in Venice and in all the old cities, and actually in all the cities where we go on holiday, you can find the people scale, 3 miles an hour scale, while in the suburbs you can find the 50 miles an hour scale where everything is too big and the signs are too large and the buildings are enormous and people feel as if it was made for dinosaurs. What we know now, because there's been done a lot of research in the past decades, all these things are very important for our behavior, for what we like and what we don't like. And it took a while to find out that all these new things which started to happen in the 60s and 70s actually influenced the way we moved about, the way we used to like cities, then we started not to like them anymore. And we found out now more or less what people would like and what would make a nice livable environment and what would not.
And specifically, you talk about how it promotes certain, well, democracy, for example, community, for example, happiness, a sense of safety. You talk about hard edges versus soft edges. What does a hard edge versus a soft edge do to people, and where do we find them?
If you have a linear space like a street, it is a moving space. Psychologically, it signalizes to you, move on, my friend, while the square is organized in such a way that you can see what's happening there, because our eye is organized so that we can overview a space which has a maximum dimensions of about 100 by 100 meters, which we are comfortable with. And when the street starts to be too wide, so we can't see the other side properly, and when the squares disappear or starts to be too big, then we don't feel comfortable. In the same way, we don't feel comfortable if we have blank walls or big buildings thundering into the sidewalks with no details. They signalize, move on, my friend, don't stop here. While on the other side, if you have facades which are detailed with many nooks and crannies, as we had in all the old cities, then you feel much more that your body can relate to this facade. And again, there is so much more interest in walking along a string of shops which have some of their merchandise out on the street. So there's smell and color and shapes to look at. And also, I point out that such a thing as the North American porch, where you have in front of your house, you have a space which is private, but lies on the borderland between the private zone, interior, and the public zone, the street. And we have studied this in Australia, in Canada, in Europe, in America. And in all cases, you will find that in those streets, there are much more life than in streets which have what I call hard edges. We can also talk about a come-and-go house, a place where the only thing you can do when you come out is to leave it or jump into your car and get out of the place as fast as you can, as opposed to a place where your children can hang around near the entrance and they can play with other kids, and while groups of kids are forming, then they can move a little bit further out into the grass at the fringes of the street. We know about this called the edge effect, that people love to stay at the edges when they are to spend some time. We have in the dance room, ballroom, we have the wallflowers, all the people sitting around the edges waiting for the activity to start. And when the dancing stops, you hurry out to the edge. You know when you are at a reception how you move along the edge. And we also know what I call in the book the piano effect, that you get really happy if moving along the edge you come to a piano, so you have a friend in this area, so you can lean to this piano and then you are not alone, you have some solid object. All these details in the physical environment, they function psychologically as supports for you being there and you being comfortable. All this we've had to reinvent and refine through research, because for a long period, the architects really have been trying to make buildings as sleek and as glassy and as closed as possible. Virtually nothing was known about the psychology of man and how people interact with the built environment. In the old days, this was part of the tradition, this was part of all the experience, and throughout the history of man's settlement in urban areas, we have seen all these rules being obeyed because people knew about them out of experience. But when we started to plan in the big way, they threw out all these rules by mistake. Now we have come to a new era where, again, we have a shift of paradigm where we must start again carefully to make our cities and our habitat so that it responds to man. If we do it, we have a more lively and livable environment. We have a more safe environment because if people use the same spaces, they are more safe and they are perceived as more safe, where we can walk more and bicycle more, and also a good public realm and a good public transportation system. They are like brothers and sisters. You have to walk or bicycle to your light rail, and you have in the other end of the journey to move to your office or your workplace. And finally, we have come to realize that we must make cities which invite people to use their own muscles in their daily day. We will do whatever we can to make the city in such a way that it invites people to walk and bicycle as much as possible, because this kind of policy actually addresses all these important issues. And that's why you can find, say, in New York, this policy that they would like to make it more attractive to walk. They would like to make better public spaces where people can sit down and enjoy each other, enjoy looking at the life of the city. And they also have a policy of introducing bicycle lanes so that you can get around in the city by subway and by bicycle and by walking, and more or less make the use of, or the forced use of, automobiles unnecessary. That means that they have this policy of making a society which is not so dependent on automobiles. Already now in Copenhagen, 37% of all commuting to work is done on bicycles, on an excellent bicycle lane system which covers the whole city and makes it faster and more comfortable and very safe to bicycle. A lot of people do it, and more people do it every year. Melbourne and Sydney are also into this kind of policies. So is Vancouver. So you can see cities from one end of the world to the other start to address this issue that we will have to make cities which are much more people-friendly.
You were talking about what you've done in Copenhagen, and one of the things that I understand was there is where you put the bike lanes that created a sense of safety for bicycle riders. Could you explain what you have done there?
In my city here in Copenhagen, they look upon bike lanes just in the same way as sidewalks. We have this old tradition in cities that in front, along all buildings, there shall be a sidewalk, so you can walk all over the city. And they actually treat bike lanes in the same way. So next to the sidewalk, they have the bike lane. And that means that the system of bike lanes almost reach every single door in the city. And then the parked cars are placed on the outside of the bike lane so that the parked cars protect the bicycles. And this is also called Copenhagen-style bike lanes. In many cities, I've seen, of course, the system where you have the parked cars next to the sidewalk, and then you have painted some stripes on the outside of the parked cars and put some bicycle symbols. That means that the bicyclists are to protect the parked cars, which, of course, is much more dangerous than the other system where you put the bike lanes next to the sidewalk and inside the parked cars. A very important part in the bicycle systems, which we see in Holland and Denmark and other places, are that the intersections are the place which is really dangerous in a bicycle system. And say in Copenhagen, we have special bike crossings like we have pedestrian crossings. We have special lights for bicycles which comes out, which turns green before the light for the cars, so the bicycles can get across before the cars even think of starting after the red light. All this makes it much, much safer to bicycle than it was previously.
normally people would not connect to design of a city that you connect. And one of them is a design that promotes democratic expression. How can a city be designed in a way that promotes democratic expression?
We can close our eyes and think of a city where no people visit outdoors, where most of the life is going on indoors in front of computers, and goods are delivered, and information you get about the surroundings you get through the television. So you all the time see pictures of what other people have seen here and there, as opposed to another city where, as part of your daily day pattern, you move about in streets where your neighbors also move about, or your fellow students or your workmates. We know from crime prevention studies that it's a very good crime prevention strategy to make sure that there are people in the streets and let people from different groups in society naturally meet each other and realize that there are many different types of people, many age groups, many cultural groups and ethnic groups in society, and the vast majority are nice and wonderful people which you can identify yourself with these. And we know that it's very important for the feeling of safety and friendliness in a neighborhood that you have this chance to meet your people in the course of your day. And also, I do think that it's a very important thing for the whole notion of democracy that we can meet our fellow citizens, and also that we have public forum where we can express our viewpoints or express our moods towards each other. I know that in the American Constitution, you have in the very First Amendment this rule that everybody has the right to, I think it's address your fellow citizens in the public forum.
The right to assemble?
Yeah, the right to assemble. And it captures very much this thing that if there is no public forum and that you have all your information about society is controlled and piped to you, then you get a very distorted picture of the society and your neighborhood and your city. And basically, you generally get quite scared about what is out there. In other cities like Melbourne and Copenhagen, where they have this policy of getting people out on the streets as much as possible and out of the cars, you have this feeling of a much friendlier city, a city of people instead of a city of noise and fumes and automobiles maybe. But I certainly think that a people-friendly city can also have automobiles to serve a number of the needs, and we can have coexistence. But we have been for many years too observant to the needs of the automobiles, and we have neglected the needs of the human beings. My book is very much about getting a better balance here. In 1961, a very famous American journalist, Jane Jacobs, in New York, wrote a book called The Life and Death of Great American Cities, where she pointed out that with this big speed in modern city planning and the invasion of the motor car, that if the modern city planners and the traffic planners came to rule the cities, the great cities would be dead cities. And she was absolutely right. But it has taken us about 50 years really to find all about this and try to turn the supertanker around. And now it is very interesting to see in many, many cities, they are full speed into making much more people-friendly cities, having realized that the other model was not too smart in the long run.
So suppose you were going to take a city that is very sprawled out, like Los Angeles, that is definitely built around the automobile.
I know.
And it's congested, although they're converting the downtown into more of a walkable city. It still obviously needs considerable work. What would you recommend for those kinds of cities, particularly in the U.S., the Midwestern cities, a lot of them are like that, Middle America, Los Angeles. Where would city designers, architects, and planners start?
That's a little tall order here in the little radio program to solve the problems of mankind. I think if I could answer your question, there's really a market out there. But maybe we can start with New York, because New York is, of course, not like the other American cities, but it's amazing what Mayor Michael Bloomberg and his staff achieved in just 3 years in pouring out bicycle lanes, in widening the sidewalks, in turning greater parts of Broadway into a boulevard with great sidewalks, in closing Broadway to traffic and creating a rather fabulous public spaces on Herald Square and Times Square, Madison Square, Union Square, and see all the changes this has made to New York in just 3 years. This is amazing. But I know that the fabric in New York is not the fabric of sprawl. But I could take the example of Melbourne. In Melbourne, they are 3 million people, and they realize that in span of 20, 30 years, they need to find room for another 3 million. And they have made a complete plan of how they can double the population without spreading the city further by building up not high density but medium density along the railway lines and the tram lines and the public transportation lines. In this way, they could, leaving 90% of all the suburbs alone, but they could have then bands of denser urban fabric built around good public transportation services. And also these bands will have a number of other services. They will have cultural services, and that will help everyone in the suburbs, because now they will have much closer to services than they have. And there are plans for this in a number of places, and in some places they are full speed doing it, like in Brisbane and in Sydney. They also have this notion of the city of villages. Frankly speaking, it is not very easy, because we have spread out enormously over the past 30, 40 years. Every problem you mention, there's always one or two places in the world where they have found a solution. And the trick is very much to find out where the solutions are for this problem or the other, to show examples from all 5-6 continents.
Well, thank you so very much, Dr. Jan Gehl, for joining us here.
You're most welcome.
Dr. Jan Gehl is Professor Emeritus of Urban Design at the School of Architecture in Copenhagen, Denmark. He's the author of the book Cities for People and an award-winning architect.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible.
To Sud Dongre, our webmaster,
Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.